Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:22 PM, and that is Central Time. Today is July 30th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with Apple because the share has held on to its breakout, and that's encouraging because it had the failed upside break in January, and that came back and tested the sequence of higher reaction lows, and it has continued to hold support in the region of the 200-day moving average, which is also a positive development, and so far it's held this break above 140. What I find particularly relevant is that Apple did say they had a very good second quarter and that they don't anticipate the third or fourth quarters being as good. And that makes sense. People bought a lot of iPads and phones during the pandemic. It's not like they're going to have to go out and buy more or replace them quickly. So keeping up that kind of outsized demand for their products when the majority of places are attempting to open back up, well, it's unlikely that they'll be able to sustain that kind of momentum. But the share price was still quite firm for the simple reason that Apple is also buying back its shares and doing so in a, I think, what might be considered a financial engineering kind of way. So Apple, with a AAA rated bond rating, has got access to extraordinarily cheap capital. So rather than using their cash, they would rather go out and borrow the money. So they borrowed about $6 billion in here this week. The other factor, of course, is that Apple has money from all over the world, and they got a holiday for bringing a lot of that money home when the Trump tax cuts were announced. And prior to that, the way that companies had been able to deal with the challenge of repatriating money was to issue debt instead of trying to repatriate the cash, because you're only taxed on profits and debts are not a profit, they're a liability. So therefore, on the balance sheet, it was just a simple way of repatriating money for a small cost. And when you have a AAA rated credit rating, well, then that cost is particularly small. So because Apple continues to buy back their shares, then I think that's one of the primary contributing factors in why it's been able to sustain this breakout. And I think the contrast that we have with Amazon in here this week is also relevant, because Amazon doesn't buy back its shares, and they also said that they are unlikely to be able to sustain their growth rate in coming quarters. So historically, Amazon has relied upon its rapid pace of growth to encourage investors to participate. But when they're not buying back their shares, and they are also telling the market that they're not going to grow as quickly, well, then that is weighing on the share price, and this looks like a failed upside break. So it has not sustained the breakout, and it has pulled back below the $3,500 area, and it is now testing the sequence of higher reaction lows. And the lower side of the range is around 3,000, and it would be quite normal to see the price come down to test that 3,000 level following a failed upside break, and particularly one where the dynamic of the failure is larger than the dynamic of the breakout. So Amazon is certainly taking some of the brunt of this selling pressure because they don't buy back their shares. But there is, of course, the broader point here, and it is that online companies did spectacularly well during the pandemic, and they got a massive quantity of market share from brick and mortar stores that it might otherwise have taken them years to achieve. So now the question is whether they'll be able to continue to hold on to that. And the selling pressure that we saw on Amazon today fed through into some weakness on Mercado Libre as well. And that's basically the Latin American version of Amazon. Etsy was also in negative territory. I do find it interesting that Google seems to put in some of these higher growth shares with lots of overhead room. and it doesn't do that for more established companies. But it was a big downward dynamic today, particularly as it countermanded the big upward dynamic that we saw last week. So it's going to have to hold the $150 area, or this is going to look increasingly like a type 2 top for completed top formation with right hand extension. So when we then think about everything that's been going on over the course of the last 6 months, we had a bit of a shakeout in the online sector earlier in the year, and then we've had it rebound really quite impressively. And we can also think about Shopify, where it got up and pushed on to new all-time highs last week, and that was a really impressive breakout. So now it's going to have to hold this move, and we did not have follow-through on the upside in here this week, so it has come back down to test that $1,500 area. Now the big question is it going to hold it? Because we can think about the outlook for the online sector. When people had to shop online, they did, and sales went through the roof for some of these companies. But they don't have to now. And the reality is that people like shopping. And the way that it's sold to investors is that why would anyone ever want to go out to a brick and mortar store? But certainly Mrs. Tracy likes shopping, and she likes shopping online, and she likes shopping in brick and mortar stores as well. And she likes the sensation of walking around and making discoveries, and I suspect that a lot of people are feel like that, and it's not just women either. So when we think about what the outlook is, there's always going to be room for brick and mortar, and there's always going to be room for e-commerce in the retail sector, and it's never going to be all one way. So we're seeing a lot of retail operations adopt hybrid models where they're retail locations or showrooms, and then they just do online delivery. So it's turning more into a delivery service rather than an online shopping experience, or that one supplements the other. And that would appear to be the future of retail. And then for the majority of people who've been cooped up for a year, well, they really are eager to get back into more of an environment where they can just go out and socialize. One thing that I think is particularly interesting is Mattel has rebounded from the region of the trend mean in here today, but this highlights something that is, I think, less remarked upon. We've seen a lot of commentary about inflationary pressures over the course of the last while, but I found this graphic to be particularly interesting this week, because what we can see is that there were large numbers of economic statistics had been in deflationary form for an awfully long time, and that was particularly true of toys. You can see that from 1999 through to 2021, so a whole 22 years, the cost of toys had declined. And now we're starting to see inflation. So this is a very, very big difference. Now, it might turn into one of these spotty kinds of phenomena, but the reality is that people have money, and they have kids at home that have been cooped up for a long time, and they are also spending a lot of time on YouTube, and a lot of the content on YouTube devoted to children is toy reviews. And basically, they spend their entire time watching advertising, and then they bug their parents until they concede, so that they'll go out and buy new toys. So that's a good news story for Mattel. And they are turning this increasing demand, as well as the shortages from suppliers and the increasing costs from transportation, into their favor, and prices are going up. And prices for sporting goods are also rising. And of course, sporting goods also includes guns and other such items as well. But it's also things like treadmills, which have been rising in costs. And of course, we've had some episodes of in price inflation from new cars and trucks in the past, and particularly after the credit crisis. But then in 2017, they were in negative territory, and now the kind of change we've had in the price of new cars and trucks is higher than it was immediately after the credit crisis. So this is another example of where we're starting to see some supply chain issues feed through into inflation. And used cars are at prices that are approximating new cars. So this is also reflective of this supply inelasticity. So when we look at all of these together, where we've seen significant jumps in commodities and significant jumps in everything from furniture to appliances to tools, well, this is all feeding through into the perception of inflation. And it's the kinds of companies that have pricing power during an inflationary period. Well, they then tend to do well. So Amazon is certainly going to have pressure there, because it's reliant on large numbers of sellers, and those sellers will have to increase their prices. Amazon will then gain, because they take a percentage of final value, then they will also see their earnings increase as inflationary pressures rise. So even though they don't anticipate sales keeping pace with what we saw in the first and second quarters of this year, they are still likely to see a benefit from inflationary pressures overall. Of course, there is the other way of looking at that, and it is that the rising costs of shipping things around the world, that's putting the profitability of smaller retailers in danger. And the Baltic Dry Index continues to hold its breakout. So there's been a fair share of volatility, and that is not at all unusual in what's a reasonably illiquid price structure. But I think it's worth considering that this has only just broken out, and what we are seeing left and right, and particularly in earnings calls, is that corporations are talking about rising shipping costs and the high cost of shipping, and that it is, and you have Tim Cook from Apple saying that they're paying more for transportation than they'd like to. And yet, prices today, relative to where they were in 2006 and 7 and 8, are at only a fraction of those levels. In fact, they're still only at a fraction of levels that they were back in 2003 and 4. So instead of it being simply about the price of the ship, it's instead that the cost of everything else has gone up a lot in between. So the cost of ports, the cost of transportation from factories to ports, and just the cost of labor to get people to unload, and then all of these additional costs are being layered on top of the raw shipping cost. So even though the shipping cost has just broken out, it's all the other costs on top of it are contributing to a significant uptick in the price of shipping goods. And like I said, this has only just broken out. So it's really likely that what we are really looking at is only the dawn of significantly higher shipping costs. And this is obviously going to then also factor through, because the tariffs that were imposed upon China have not gone away, and those are also resting on top of the shipping costs. And there's the potential, at least, that those tariffs might increase, because it looks increasingly likely that now it was being opined about previously, we have plenty of evidence of it now, that the attitude of Washington, D.C., regardless of political orientation, has changed towards China. So that's going to continue to contribute to this questioning of just how what kind of rationale there would be for removing tariffs, and perhaps it might be better to just increase the tariffs in order to force migration of productive capacity away from China. But the tariffs have certainly also added on to the continuing increases in costs. So when we then think about what are happening in terms of inflationary pressures, well, this is something that's only just begun to trend higher. And of course, we now have the carbon trading program that's being vastly expanded in Europe, and just announced that they're going to, well, I guess announced in the last month that they're going to implement it in China. So the carbon prices continue to hold around the €50 level in Europe, and this is a politically mandated price structure. So it's not about supply and demand. It's simply about how much do the politicians want the price of carbon to be. And that is contributing to inflationary pressures. But one thing that I think is particularly relevant is when we think about what's happening with companies like Exxon. Now, the share price was in negative territory today, and that was following the announcement of a buyback. And they have continued to pay their dividend. They had to borrow money to pay the dividend last year. But what they also announced is that they are making it a priority to rebuild their balance sheet. And all energy companies are going to have to do that because they're going to need the war chest. So Exxon has rolled over somewhat, and it bounced last week from the region of the trend mean. Now, the big question is whether it can continue to hold that level, because the real potential is that these companies are going to have to, well, they'll probably be able to continue to sustain their dividends. And when we think about both Exxon and Chevron, well, they've been able to sustain their dividends. But that's not the only thing that they should be thinking about. They'll also have to be thinking about how they're going to fight this war, because it is a war for the sustainability of their businesses. They did phenomenally well in 2020 from selling plastics, and there is an emerging trend towards advocating against the use of single-use plastics. So we have the moratorium on plastic straws in different places. There was the efforts to get rid of Q-tips and in stores as well, because they were single-use plastic items. And that is only likely to accelerate, and particularly as we look at the vast quantity of single-use items that were used in I guess in response to the pandemic. And it's the chemicals sector that is likely to do well as a result of that transition, because it's the materials and chemicals sector who are developing the environmentally friendly plastics, those that can biodegrade. So Solvay is one of those, BASF is another one of those, and it's not all that surprising that a number of these companies looking at alternatives to reliance on fossil fuels are in Europe, because Europe is a significant energy importer. But the challenge is that this is a baby industry, that it's really in its infancy, and that it's going to take both time, and also I think there will have to be political will to force some form of change in terms of consumption. When we think about where we are in terms of this cycle, well, it's I think likely that we're going to see at least some pause and consolidation before long. And the S&P 500 has been going sideways for four, actually it's more like 6 days, and it was in negative territory in here today, but so far holding the breakout. I think the most important thing to remember is that we still have a sequence of higher reaction lows. We still have ranges one above another, and we also have a short-term overbought condition relative to the trend mean. at some stage we'll get a deeper process of consolidation. But in order for that to happen, we will need to see at least the supply of additional liquidity drying up. And this week was particularly notable because we've had what was a de facto standing repo facility, then it was changed into a real standing repo facility. And one thing that I think is particularly important is we need to think about the overnight repo event that happened back in 2019. So that was, I think, one of the most important factors, that we had a really significant run-up in the repo price, and that was in response to this seizing up in the repo market because of a problem in the high-yield sector. So repo got up in a dynamic manner. I'm not exactly, don't remember if this was exactly the right chart at the time, but it does help to illustrate that we had this big pop on the upside in the repo rate at this point here, around the beginning of 2019. Well, I'm not going to get the date correct, but there was a $450 billion infusion into the repo market. And that was the beginning of what is effectively a de facto standing repo facility. Then we saw at the beginning of 2020, in response to the pandemic, that there were significant swap lines opened up. And the number of swap lines that have been opened up over the course of the last 20 years is really quite profound. So the interconnectedness of the global economy is something that I think is less appreciated. It's something that certainly tends to come back into focus when we start to think about what the outlook is for the global economy during a crisis. But these swap lines too tend to be forgotten during periods of quiet. And when we think about what it all means in terms of the standing repo facility, repo is used by banks, and it's not just domestic banks. They lend to each other on an overnight basis, and they use that to ensure that they meet their capital requirements on, or at least the borrower does that to ensure that they meet their capital requirements on an overnight basis. The lender does so that they can pick up an attractive overnight rate in potentially a different currency. So this is an example of what swap lines looked like in 2015. This is an example of what they looked like in 2009. So we can see that there's been a very substantial change. It used to be the ASEAN region and then NAFTA. Then it's really gone global since then, and it's probably even more global today in the aftermath of the credit crisis, of the pandemic. What that effectively means is that the Federal Reserve is backstopping the entire global financial sector. And when pressures arise within the repo market, then they are leaving themselves open to requirements to provide liquidity. Now, the Fed believes, and there's an interesting article that was produced by the, I think it's the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. And what they basically said back in 2019 was that, and I can pull this up, that they thought that introducing a standing repo facility would require minimally ample reserves, and it would reduce the demand for reserves. So they had some rationale for thinking about that, and a good part of that rationale is that they have an example from the pandemic that they said they would go out and buy corporate bonds, and simply by saying it, they didn't have to do it. And the market took care of the rest for them. So this is exactly why we had this significant rebound in high yield from that nadir in March of 2020. So just by saying that they do it, then markets took them at their word. So that's exactly what the Federal Reserve is doing today. They've created a standing repo facility, and they believe that by saying that they'll do what's necessary, they'll step in if it's ever required, they'll provide as much liquidity as is required, that they'll won't have to do it, and that they would only have to do it in extremis, and that since they would do it in extremis anyway, well, then there's no harm, and perhaps there are greater benefits to simply saying and to formalizing that relationship. And that's all well and good as long as the origin of a potential problem in the future arises within the USA. And the challenge in future is that US banks will have invested heavily outside the US. And then a problem will occur in a foreign banking sector. And subsequently, because of the feedback loop into the domestic market, then money on an unlimited basis will have to be made available to the repo markets. So that leaves the Federal Reserve open to unlimited liability from a foreign source of illiquidity. And that's not at all impossible in the future. We can simply think about the significant quantity of money that the US banking sector, particularly investment banks, are devoting to their expansion into China. And China has told them that they can even own all of their own banking operations, or they can own a majority of their banking operations in the country. And China is simply diversifying their risk. And they're ensuring that whenever there is going to be a big problem in their banking sector, in their property sector, that it becomes everybody's problem and not just their own. So what we can therefore think about in future is that there will be a crisis, and it might not even be a US crisis, and the Federal Reserve will be on the hook for bailing it out, and that it is going to represent a massive increase in the quantity of money that is printed. So, as we think about what's happening here, well, gold prices were in positive territory yesterday and then gave up most of the advance in here today. So, we're still in an environment where investors are not quite willing yet to give the benefit of the doubt to the inflationary message. And I think the primary rationale for that is the Delta variant, because we continue to have these pieces of news. The first being that the Delta variant is as contagious as chickenpox. Well, I know growing up, when one child had chickenpox, every child in the neighborhood was sent around to play with that kid so that everybody would get it at the same time and just get it done with. And that was certainly what happened with me and my siblings. Well, everybody knew that if you simply put a child into the same room as another child with chickenpox, they would get it, and it is extremely virulent. So, if by putting out that story, or I guess what is probably more correct is leaking that story, then the CDC is sending a message to people that the Delta variant is extremely contagious. And then on top of it, they're saying that there are 110,000 confirmed breakthrough infections. So there are people who were covered by the original vaccines are now contracting the Delta variant, and they have the potential to pass it on to other people. Now, there is no data that I've seen to tell us how many new infections from the coronavirus have originated from people that have been vaccinated. And I doubt we're going to get it either, because that piece of information is being withheld, or it is being used, its absence is being used as a rationale to encourage people to become vaccinated. So certainly there are still holes in the kind of data that we're being presented with, and this kind of suspicious attitude that people have when they're offered incomplete information isn't going to change anytime soon. So I think this is certainly something that needs to be taken into account, because politicians want to get the economy opened back up. And the way that they're going to open it back up is they're going to have vaccine mandates. So it's going to become increasingly likely that if you want to work in an office or you want to travel, then you'll have to have a vaccination. And that will also likely be true of travel. And I think that's something that also needs to be considered, that one of the primary reasons why the stock market is still firm, despite the growing risks and the negative news that is coming through about the Delta variant, investors are betting one, that the UK numbers, where the number of cases of the Delta variant have peaked and are now coming back down rather swiftly, that it's not just because the initial spike was because of the European Championships, but rather that there is sufficient immunity in the, or at least already in the population, that the onward push for the virus is not quite as strong as was being anticipated. So then, when we think about where are we in terms of the wider market, it's likely that one way or another more people will be inoculated, and on the other side of that equation, then the overall threat is perhaps not quite as high as the media are making it out to be. So therefore, this downward push that we saw on gold is probably more to do with stress in the stock market, and then the stock and the bond yield continues to push lower, and this is a new closing low for at least the last week. We had a pop on the upside yesterday, it countermanded it in here today. We need to see at least a break above the 1. Let me make sure that I'm talking correctly, 1.3% level, in order to break the sequence of lower rally highs and signal more than temporary supply dominance. Now, when we think about the dollar index, it was in positive territory in here today and steadying in the region of the trend mean. I continue to think that this, on a longer term basis, this looks like a developing top formation. And the very real potential that the USA will be tested, or this, well, perhaps more that the Federal Reserve's resolve will be tested with its standing repo facility eventually, and that it is an unlimited liability. That is something that will weigh on the dollar eventually. Now, when we think about the other big story that came out this week with China, when we think about the H-share index, which are the big mainland companies listed in Hong Kong, well, it's well off its low in here this week. And I suspect that we will have upside follow-through next week, because this is a state-mandated rally. So we've had a meaningful move in terms of the sell-off, and if we just look at this over the last 5 days, well, we can see that the semiconductor sector was up 24%, Geely Automotive was up nearly 10%, and BYD was up 5%. So these are certainly the most favored sectors by the Communist administration. Heidi Lau, China Evergrande, just in the last 5 days, they were down 29% and 27% each. So We might also consider that these are the less well-regarded companies. And then the banks, state-owned banks, and the less well-remarked upon success stories from the tech sector, although Ant Sports is really just a retailer, they have fallen less. China tried a version of the plunge protection team when they called in the CEOs of, or the regional CEOs of the major investment banks this week to tell them that the significant efforts that they have put in place to neuter the tutoring sector are going to be confined to the tutoring sector. Now, it's not like this isn't a just cause, and the corruption that has been evident in the tutoring sector is significant, and paying teachers to funnel students to tutoring services has been going on for years, and it has all gone on at the expense of parents. So it's certainly something that people have been complaining about for a long time, and this has certainly been something that has it was enormously rewarding for investors, and it is a salve for popular opinion to target some of these companies. But the manner in which it was achieved, and there is again, this is ruled by law and not of law. I think that's one of the other big points here. So when we think about, I did see, let me see if I can find it. I saw this graphic today, which I thought was really quite funny, and it's playing on the ad for a watch brand. But you never actually own a Chinese stock; you merely look after it for the Politburo. I thought was really quite funny, because they might be saying that this was a just cause and that it needed to be done, and that it's going to be isolated. But this is not an isolated case. This is only the latest in a series of cases where government intervention can be extremely heavy-handed. And the reality is that the Communist Party doesn't care about the stock market. And investors need to, I think, get that into their heads, that when President Trump was tweeting on a daily basis about strong returns in the stock market, that was representative of the wider population who actually look at the stock market. Well, in China, people do tend to look at the stock market, but they own property. So, in fact, when companies then are successful, well, domestic investors haven't really had an opportunity to invest in companies like Alibaba or Tencent. They haven't been listed in the mainland indices, and particularly not when they were in their infancies. So they weren't really invested in those companies. So the political cost for the Communist Party to intervene in these companies is really quite low. So telling Alibaba and Tencent that they've basically been neutered, that there are clear limits on their ability to grow, they will not be allowed to buy other companies or invest in additional sectors, and that they are going to have to contribute whatever data they have into a central repository, and that the government is going to foster much more competition, and that the data moat that these types of companies have relied on will be taken away from them. So we can then think about how that would play out if it were to happen in another jurisdiction. What if the government went along and said to Amazon that their web services business is wonderful and that it is now government property, and that the data built up by pharmaceutical companies is no longer theirs, and that it will all have to be contributed to a central repository, and that the data built up by Tesla from all the cars that it's been driving around on the roads no longer belongs to it, and that it will also end up in this central repository, and that any company willing to pay for access will have access to all of that combined data, and that the government will enable anyone who wants to try and create products and services from it to compete with the larger companies. So it's a race to the bottom. And what the administration wants is significant progress on the stated goals. So the stated goals are independence in semiconductors and first to cross the line in terms of autonomous vehicles and to develop a domestic biotechnology sector. So these are the stated objectives. And when we think about the Chinese semiconductor industry, it's behind the rest of the developed world, but they're willing to spend money on it. So Semiconductor Manufacturing International, you can see clearly here that there are sanctions apply to this security if you're a US investor. That's not necessarily true if you're from anywhere else. And the share was up in a dynamic manner in here today. So the Chinese semiconductor industry is something that will continue to be favored and will have the blessing of heaven. So when we think about the sectors that did well and have served their purposes, well, they're not going to have nearly as much support. Nevertheless, we with the intervention that we saw this week, it is likely that companies like Tencent and Alibaba can rally from here. It's nonetheless, it's going to be reasonably limited because they have been neutered, and they're not going to be growing at the same pace in the future that they've been able to achieve in the past. So that particular portion of their growth has in fact ended. Now the bigger question is, what are they going to do about China Evergrande? Because, and I think when we think about who owns it and who owns Alibaba, well, then I think we have our answer. Because Chinese people do own property, and a significant problem in the property markets will feed directly through into the perception of economic health and prosperity for the vast majority of Chinese people. And China Evergrande is the biggest debtor in the emerging markets universe. And we should remember why that is the case. So, property companies have an ongoing demand for liquidity, and they had a comfortable relationship with banks and local governments for years. And that was closed off because there were fears that a property bubble was inflating. Then they set up shadow banking. So these private lending clubs were introduced, and those were offering extremely high yields. It ensured that the flow of money to property developers persisted. And then that was also cut off. So their next route was to go off and issue US dollar denominated debt. And China went from pretty much nowhere to issuing in excess of $500 billion worth of US dollar denominated debt. And then that was also choked off because there was a real fear that it was becoming the figure was becoming too large, the demand and appetite was voracious for US dollar denominated debt, and it was creating a potential future liability in the event that the dollar were ever to appreciate in a meaningful manner, then it would cause significant problems. So that was also cut off. Then we had the pandemic. So we're now in a situation where the routes to accessing cheap liquidity for the property markets have evaporated. And the price of property in China is extremely high, and we've had these meaningful moves higher in terms of the price of property in tier three cities. So we can look at this chart of the price of property in tier one cities. So tier one would be Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Tianjin, and Chengdu. So those are the big cities, and there have been efforts underway for the last 3 or 4 years to try and stop prices from appreciating there. So you had leakage, and over the course of the last 3 years, we've seen that prices in regional cities, the kinds of places that really most people have never heard of, like Urumqi, have been trending higher in a significant manner, and over the course of the last decade have doubled. So we continue to see significant price appreciation in Chinese property markets, and we're starting to see that the property developers are trending lower. So when we look at China Evergrande, it's accelerating lower. Now, there's no real impetus to go off and save Tencent or save Alibaba, but as the Shanghai Property Index comes down to test the lower side of a almost 7-year range, well, I think we're getting increasingly close to when there will be a range of measures introduced to support the property market, because China really can't afford for these companies to go bust. And the feedback loop into the wider economy, where property now represents about 13% of the economy, up from 5%, and this is significant. And if there are clear efforts underway to undermine the reliance on property, well, there's going to have to be an additional problem, or an additional plan, I should say, in to come up with a way to compensate for that loss of productivity in the property sector. If China is going to weigh on the property market, if the Communist Party has made the determination that rising property prices are a threat to single-party rule, then that's a problem. That is something that is going to weigh on everything. So when we think about the FTSE China A50, it's also rolling over in here. When we think about the banking sector, well, let me see if I can remember the banking sector, and I'm not going to succeed doing that. So when we do think about China's banks, then this, I think, is going to be particularly relevant. When we think about where all that money has come from to support property prices, then we have to think that that money came from somewhere. So that's, I think, particularly relevant for the state-owned banking sector, where we talk about the value of property, it's upwards around of around 7 trillion. So when we think about China's banking sector overall, well, that's somewhere in the nether regions of valuation, because these bank valuations have been heavily supported by the wider government interrelationship between the government, the banking sector, and local governments. State-owned banks are among the largest in the world, and then they also have these very opaque balance sheets. So they're going to be called upon to provide liquidity, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be profitable. And the potential is that there will be more non-performing loans. So the big question then for China is, are they willing to go ahead and take the pain now, because they believe it's a geopolitical imperative, and that if they take the pain of restructuring today, that they'll come out in a stronger position later, so that when the USA will eventually have to restructure, and I don't think anyone is under any real illusion that the US will have to restructure eventually, that China will come out in a stronger position. And they may be thinking about this in the same way that, or at least using Germany as an example. Germany went through reunification. It absorbed the debts of East Germany, and it absorbed a large, low-paid workforce, and it introduced taxes for reunification, and they're still in place, and it went through a painful but worthwhile exercise of improving efficiency and productivity, so that when it went into the EU and created the Eurozone, there was probably no other country was as prepared as Germany to compete. And it benefited it enormously as a result of that. And I do wonder if this is what China is thinking about today. Are they thinking that this bubble that has arisen in the property market is becoming a social ill, and they are thinking that if they can bring down the price of property and restructure the banking sector, that they'll be in a much stronger competitive position with stronger balance sheets overall when the USA eventually does have to restructure? We know that the US is running massive deficits, and that the quantity of debt outstanding is enormous, and that it is increasing in magnitude, and the willingness of the governments of the USA and increasingly Europe to spend their way out of trouble, and the massive just unquantifiable liabilities that are outstanding because of promises in terms of social services and wages and pensions will eventually have to be resolved. So that can get kicked down the road almost indefinitely, but eventually there will have to come a time when it has to be dealt with. And historically, these kinds of events are resolved with a war. So that has to at least be out there on the back burner, that eventually the debts will be and you'll get a debt jubilee, but you don't generally get a debt jubilee voluntarily. It's usually imposed. And it's imposed because the debts are so large, and there is simply a reset button. And that doesn't generally happen until after a great deal of pain. When we think about the quantity of outstanding debt and the unlimited liabilities that that central banks are becoming exposed to, the fact that the EU is at a point now where the size of their balance sheet is accelerating higher, and they're creating socialized debt for the entire region. So we're certainly in an environment where debt is increasing, and the big question is, if China is doing this, well, they're going against the grain, and they're introducing medicine to the high leverage environment that nowhere else is willing to do, and they would only do that if they thought that they wouldn't, that the single party rule would not survive a crash. So perhaps they're thinking that perhaps they should take the pressure from restructuring the property market now, rather than it be forced upon them in future. And that's, I guess, that's really just a prognostication. I have no data to back that up, and it's a guess on my behalf. But I certainly look at the downward trend that we see on China Evergrande, the pressure that is coming to bear on the banking sector, and the clear determination to weigh on the technology sector and to try and build up the areas where China thinks they can have a competitive advantage in future. Well, all of that is aimed at a universal goal of ensuring that the government survives. We're still in a bull market overall, and we're still in an environment which is incredibly liquidity rich. And this trend that we have right now is eerily similar to what we had in 2016 and 17. And in early 2018, we started to see interest rates rising. So it's also worth considering that the taper tantrum was in 2013, and the stock market didn't look back. And we had the Trump tax cuts in 2016 and 17, and the stock market didn't look back until we got into a phase of quantitative tightening. And now we are in this, again, extremely benign environment where we have inflationary pressures that are rising on one hand, but not everywhere. So some of the pressures are transitory and some aren't. And wages in particular are not transitory. And the shipping rates rising all over the world, in part because of carbon, in part because of IMO 2020, and in part because of increasing awareness of the ills of bunker fuel, well, that's likely to contribute to inflationary pressures overall. But modest inflation and then the and modest growth are a benign environment for stocks overall. It's when we start to get inflationary pressures scaring central banks so that they aggressively raise interest rates is when we should really worry about the stock market and the significant leverage that has been built up. I find it really, I think, important to highlight that there's no two cycles are exactly the same. And Lucid Motors IPO'd in here today. So the share of the SPAC popped on the upside back in February, but the share has in fact gone public in here today, and it's at a valuation of 38 billion. 38 billion is still a lot of money, and this is for a company that has not yet produced a car. So we can then think about Nikola and their plans to produce a hydrogen fuel cell truck, and the share rocketed higher about a year ago, up to over $70, and now it's closer to 11. And Lordstown Motors, that's another example of a company that was able to soar on the promise of an IPO, and the share is down from 30 to 6. So we're certainly in an environment where there is a lot of money floating around, and the quantity of low interest rate loans and the willingness of private equity investors to invest in the next Tesla, that has allowed hundreds of billions of dollars to be allocated to these companies that might never produce a vehicle. So these are significant factors in this emerging market, that we have enormous money being devoted to these speculative ventures, and it's in a casino-like environment. And it's been shown to work that you can diversify your risk by investing in lots of risky ventures. So rather than diversifying by only investing in some risky ventures, the private equity model is that you invest in lots of risky ventures, and that even if 9 out of 10 go bust, the one that comes off will pay for the rest. And that works really well when we have low interest rates and the cost of participation is low. I think anyone who's ever traded commodities might have something else to point out. When we look at what happened with coffee this week, we had a significant pop on the upside last week in response to the frost in Brazil. And in response to that surge higher, the exchange raised the margin. And by raising the margin, it increased the cost of participation for any trader who was involved in the market. And then, when the freezing weather failed to follow through and affect the crop in here today, well, then the price came down with a bang. Now, if we then think and take that exact same logic and transfer it to the private equity sector, well, you can invest in on based upon any rationale you wish, and you can invest in as many of those ideas as you like. But interest rates are like a margin hike at a commodity exchange, and when you have to pay more for making your bets, well, then you have to be a little bit more judicious about how you deploy your capital. So we're in this sort of environment where everybody thinks that they can invest in anything, and as long as they invest in enough of those things, that enough of them will be right, that all the other mistakes will evaporate. And when that kind of business model first originated, people were still doing due diligence, whereas what people are doing today is just investing in everything. And there's the real possibility that the vast majority of them will go bust, and that will result in a large quantity of people going bust with them. And it's all about higher interest rates. So bond yields are still trending downwards, and this will continue. But this is indicative of a bubbly environment. So we are in the throes of an inflating bubble, and they can go up for longer than anyone anticipates, and they can go on for longer than many anticipate. And the number one thing to pay attention to is the willingness of central banks to tolerate it. So we're in an environment today where central banks have said in plain English that they're not going to raise interest rates until inflation is trending higher. And there's a good reason to believe that inflation will eventually trend higher, because that's what central bankers want. Over the course of the last 40 years, it's the last thing they wanted. And any time it looked like inflation was going to trend higher, well, they intervened and stopped it. And that translated into an environment of low inflation. So now we have a psychological change in how central bankers are adapting. So now they are willing to tolerate inflation. And as long as they are, in fact, willing to do that, well, then we'll have inflation. And that will eventually force up interest rates, and it will have a significant effect on the sectors that are most susceptible to higher interest rates. And I do think that this business model developed by Sunrun is a perfect example of that. And as long as we have interest rates that are staying low, then that kind of business model, where they are very asset heavy and rely on a long interval of low interest rates to allow the debt payments to come in, then that's something that can fuel a continued advance as long as interest rates stay down. If interest rates rise, well, then the company goes bust. So it's a very polarized way of looking at the market. I do think that there is still potential for additional upside in markets. We don't have any evidence that central banks are, in fact, on the cusp of tapering. And until they do, then I think we are still going to see continued asset price inflation. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.